Thank you all for coming out here. I'm going to spend a little bit of time tonight talking about Islam and terrorism, but I've kind of entitled this The Politically Incorrect Guide to Islam and Global Terrorism, and I think as we go through some of the material, you'll see why. Partially because, if nothing else, we are right up against the fifth anniversary of September 11th. And I suspect that if I were to ask any of you where you were on September 11th, 2001, all of you would be able to tell me where you were. It was a very significant event. But even after that, what I have found is that it also caused many of us to want to know a little bit more about Islam. And I think in the last 5 years, lots of us have learned a great deal about Islam. But I have noticed over these last 5 years kind of a growing frustration on the part of some individuals that oftentimes political correctness has really clouded our ability to think clearly about Islam. So that's why I've titled this tonight. I'm going to, at least part of the time, look at some of those politically correct phrases that you hear said from time to time. I'll put those on the screen and then give you kind of a biblical response to some of those, or a political response, whatever is appropriate. And at the end, of course, I would love to have you ask questions. And also, we're going to, I think, learn a great deal together about this subject of Islam. Let me just mention that there are lots of great books out. If nothing else, the last 5 years have produced some excellent books. One book in the upper left-hand corner that's been out even before 9/11 was a book by Norman Geisler and Abdul Salib. This is a book that really helps you understand some of the theology of answering Islam. One in the lower left-hand corner by R.C. Sproul and Abdul Salib, A Dark Side of Islam. Number of books that have been written by Robert Spencer, the one down here, Islam Unveiled, and also The Politically Incorrect Guide to Islam, which is where I borrowed part of the title for this, by Robert Spencer, somebody that I interview quite a bit on a program called Point of View, which is on from 1 to 3 on the USA Radio Network. Some other books, Dunces of Doomsday, I'll get into a little bit later, is one by Paul Williams, and he has talked a lot about some of the mistakes in the war on terrorism. And in the upper left-hand corner, I would recommend all the books that come from the Kaner brothers, that is Ergun Kaner and Amir Kaner. They are former Muslims who converted to Christianity. Ergun Kaner today is at Liberty University. Amir Kaner is at Southeastern Baptist Seminary. But the point I'm making is there are lots of great resources. So if tonight you find yourself wanting to know a little bit more about this topic, I will send you to our probe website at the end, but also just mention that there are some great resources for you to read more on the topic that we're addressing. But the first thing that I want to do is begin to think about this issue of Islam when we look at what is taking place in our society. And that is that we are facing what one professor referred to as a clash of civilizations. Samuel Huntington is a professor at Harvard University, and I've had a chance to be on a platform with him. And Samuel Huntington actually predicted back in the early 1990s that ultimately we would find ourselves in a situation where there would be a clash of three major civilizations. The first civilization would be what he calls Western Universalism. That is the West and all that we've come to know about the West. And we're talking about things like equal protection under the law, equal rights, constitutionality, things that really relate to the idea of being in the West. The second civilization he talks about is what he calls Chinese assertion. That is, we can't ignore a billion Chinese, but certainly that's another major civilization. And the third is what is referred to as Muslim militancy. Muslim militancy. Now, by that, he doesn't mean that all Muslim countries are militant, but he does mean that he believes that there would be a real clash between the West and Islam. Now, recognize when he wrote that, it was the early 1990s. It was the fall of the Berlin Wall, the fall of the Iron Curtain. Many people thought we weren't going to have any more problems. We thought, in some respects, we might even be moving into a utopia. But I think he clearly saw that there was going to be a major clash between the West and Islam. And as you open up your newspapers, isn't that what we see? It seems to me that that is exactly what we have found. And so, again, that just, I think, sets the scene for some of the things that we'll be talking about tonight. Well, let's talk about some of these PC statements, some of these politically correct statements. And the first one that I want to put on the screen is that Muhammad is just like every other religious founder. As somebody speaks on college campuses, I know that sometimes in religion courses there will be a presentation and will simply say that Muhammad was like many of the other founders of major religions. But I think, as you will see in just a minute, maybe not really the case. Bernard Lewis, who is an emeritus professor from Princeton University and has written many good books on this subject, said Muhammad, it will be recalled, was not only a prophet and a teacher like the founders of other religions, he was also the head of a polity and of a community, a ruler and a soldier. And so I think it might be good for just a minute to talk about the history of Islam, and it's fairly easy and well documented, and that is Muhammad was actually born in AD 570. Before he was born, his father died. After he was born, his mother died. He was raised for a while by a grandfather, later by an uncle, and he was actually supporting himself during most of those years by traveling with caravans, and at the age of 25 was married. But then, interestingly enough, when he was 40 years of age, at AD 610, he began to have what he felt were revelations. And he came to later believe that those were revelations from God through angel Gabriel. And so these recitations were written down and thus became part of what is known as the Quran. Well, he began to preach against some of the things that were taking place there in that particular area of Mecca. And as a result, there was a fair amount of hostility. He did have some followers, but also he began to be rejected for his preaching, and some of his rage began to surface even there. And his uncle rejected his message, for example. You can read about this in the Quran, and he singled him out for judgment in hell. So even family members began to reject him, and at this point it got to be fairly dangerous, so he eventually had to leave Mecca and flee to Medina, and he did so in AD 622. If you go anywhere in the world and ask a Muslim, when did Islam start, they will all use the date 622, AD 622. In fact, if you understand a Muslim calendar, take the current date and subtract by 622, and you will get the actual date. Well, now he is in Medina, and he begins to lead an army, as we talked about just a minute ago. He raided caravans, fought a number of battles. One of the most significant ones was the Battle of Badr, in which he was able to overcome very significant forces, and it led him to write a number of things about what indeed should be part of the idea of jihad warfare. Now he was actually building up a very large army, and he was eventually able to lead 10,000 men back to Mecca, and basically took Mecca without a major fight because he had worked out deals with some of the leaders there. And he was at the very pinnacle of his power, and then 2 years later he died. As we'll see in just a minute, though, that was not the end of Islam, but the largest expansion of a world religion in the history of civilization. But as we look at this, I think we can see that Muhammad was not like your typical religious founder. And if we want to do a comparison, say, between Muhammad and Jesus, I think we see some very significant differences. The first is that we see that Muhammad is portrayed as the seal of the prophets. In Surah 33, that would be the 33rd chapter of the Quran, it talks about him being the culmination of the prophets. But interestingly enough, it also says in the Quran that he was a man like us, and that in Surah chapter 40 there, that he was actually told by Allah that he should repent of his sins. So that is the view that is held by Muslims. Christians, of course, hold a very different view of Jesus Christ. Jesus claimed to be God. We see in John 8:58 and many other passages that Jesus claimed to be one with the Father. I and the Father are one. He who has seen me has seen the Father. Who believes me believes in the Father. Before Abraham was, I am. And many other passages where Jesus made very direct and specific claims to be God. And the Bible also teaches that Jesus lived a perfect and sinless life. So I would suggest to you that if you wanted to do a comparison between Muhammad and Jesus, they're two very different individuals, and we'll look more at that in just a minute. But let's go to our second PC statement, one that I've run into occasionally. Christians and Muslims worship the same God. Have you ever heard that? Somebody shake your head. I hear that quite often. Christians and Muslims worship the same God. Let's think about that for just a minute. Because after all, if you want to understand Islam, the fundamental doctrine of Islam is monotheism. That is, that there is one God. More than that, the Quran teaches that Allah is one God, and anyone who rejects this is guilty of what is known as the sin of shirk, like idolatry. Because of that, Muslims then reject the idea of the Trinity, and that's exactly what Christianity teaches. It teaches that there is one God, but in three persons, And so I think you can see that there are some very distinct differences in terms of who God is. But more than that, there's also a very distinct difference in the nature and character of God. In Islam, Allah, the God of Islam, is actually exalted and removed from mankind. The argument is that Allah deals with the world through His Word, the Quran, through His prophets, Muhammad, and through His angels like Gabriel. But a Muslim will say, I can know God's will. I might know the will of Allah, but I will not know Him personally. That being said, Christianity is very different in terms of its teaching about the nature and character of God. We see that Jesus came into the world that we might know God, and that God so loved the world, probably the most famous passage in the New Testament, that He sent His only Son. So what I want to try to say here is that there are some very distinct differences in terms of the teaching of who God is. And if you want to use this particular chart as an illustration, you can see that on almost every major point, there is a difference. Islam would say that God is represented by Unitarian monotheism, that there is one God, a strict belief in monotheism. Christianity, or Yahweh, would believe in Trinitarian monotheism, in the idea of the Trinity. Allah is oftentimes seen in sort of a master-slave relationship. However, in Christianity, it's sort of like a father-son, father-daughter relationship. Christians can call God Abba Father. One of the key phrases that Muslim students use all the time when I'm around them is, as Allah wills, the idea that Allah determines all. It's a fatalistic, deterministic kind of view of the world, whereas Christianity believes that God is sovereign, but we still exercise free will. Allah is the author of both good and evil. Yahweh, or God of the Bible, is always good. So I think you can see on major points, they couldn't be any more different than night and day. And I think we dishonor Islam oftentimes if we were to imply that both Christianity and Islam worship the same God, because they're about as different as they might be. Now, as we go along here, I'm going to give you some application points. And here's one that I think would be very helpful. From what we've studied so far, one of the things that I think you might begin to notice is that if I'm a Christian, one of the things that might provide a great evangelistic opportunity would be to talk about the love of God. And interestingly enough, Fuller Seminary did a very interesting research project where they interviewed 600 former Muslims who had converted to Christianity. And they asked them, what was significant in your conversion from Islam to Christianity? And they almost to a person said that one of the factors involved in those conversions was the emphasis upon the love of God and the intimacy that believers can have with God as their Heavenly Father. It's been my experience talking with Muslim students and even Muslims overseas that oftentimes one of the things they find most intriguing about Christianity is that Christians talk about having a personal relationship with God. And so I do believe that the idea of the love of God is a very significant bridge builder to your Muslim friends. Most of us have Muslim friends, and I would suggest that one of the things you might want to do as you talk to your Muslim friends and as you witness to them is to make sure you share the love of God, because they, in a sense, are in a religion that sees God as transcendent, unknowable, somewhat capricious, in a fatalistic world, and to all of a sudden begin to believe that God is entering in or could enter into a personal relationship with them is a very significant point. Well, let's look at our third point, and that is, maybe you've heard this one before, Islam is a religion of peace. Ever heard that one before? Let's come back and ask ourselves that historically, and then maybe even in terms of interpretation. And that is, as I pointed out, that after Muhammad died, in 632, something dramatic took place, because rather than that being the end of Islam, it led to an enormous expansion of this religion worldwide. First, they began to expand, the Muslim armies began to expand to the east through Syria and into Persia, through what is today present-day Iraq and into present-day Iran and into what would be called today the Stan countries, Uzbekistan, Uzbekistan and others, Turkmenistan. And then also, even more significantly, began to expand through all of northern Africa and made their way into Spain and eventually were defeated in France. And this was a tremendous expansion of the religion, in large part because of the Muslim armies that swept through first the Fertile Crescent and into northern Africa. And a matter of fact, if it was not for the fact that the Muslim armies were repelled and eventually defeated by the Hammer, Charles Martel, in AD 732, most of Europe probably would have been Muslim. That wasn't the only incursion into Islam into Europe. Later on, there was another one that actually reached to the very gates of Vienna, and the Muslim armies there were defeated on September 11th, 1683. Do you see any significance about that date? I would suggest to you that there is. For us, 9/11 was just a date picked out of the air, but it was not from Osama bin Laden. If you've read his fatwas, his pronouncements, he says that one of the reasons he struck on September 11th was to revenge the defeat of the Muslims. Look when? 1683. If you read some of the fatwas by Osama bin Laden, by some of the others, Arkawi and others, sometimes they'll refer to crusaders. And what they're talking about is they're talking about the crusades. Recognize that the first crusade started in 1095. That's more than 900 years ago. We as Americans may have a short memory. Those who are leading some of these terrorist actions have a very long memory indeed. Well, let's talk about this because I think the key issue here is what does jihad mean? And that can mean different things to different Muslims. So let's talk about that for a minute. If you go to Surah 9, verses 73, you read a passage like this, "Strive hard against the unbelievers and the hypocrites and be firm against them. Their abode is hell, an evil refuge indeed." And that phrase that we translate "strive hard" is jahidi, which is really the verbal form of the noun jihad. Now, how you define that idea of jihad or striving hard will really determine what kind of individual you are. If you have a Muslim friend or a next-door neighbor that believes the jihad and striving means that you strive to conform your will to the will of Allah, they'll make a very good neighbor. If, however, they take the more traditional interpretation of jihad, and that is that the striving was to be on the battlefield, you might not want to have them as your next-door neighbor. So this, I think, is the important aspect, and I think explains why you have a range of different Muslims, from very peace-loving Muslims to those who actually want to destroy the United States, Israel, and any infidel, because it all comes back to your interpretation of that phrase, jihad. Now let me for just a minute talk about Muslim interpretation. How do you interpret the Quran? And that, again, is very significant. And that is, the Quran is actually made up of 114 surahs or chapters. And there are actually Meccan surahs and Medinan surahs. The Meccan surahs were those which were actually written when Muhammad was in Mecca and a prophet. The Medinan surahs were actually written later when then he was leading an army, and they're filled with all sorts of matters of law and ritual, and this includes exhortations to jihad. Now, there's something else that's important, and that is to recognize that, yes, there are many verses in the Quran that talk about peace. Ever heard that statement? You know, the Quran has verses about peace? Certainly that's the case. Also has about 100 verses that talk about jihad. But you've got to recognize that the verses that talk about peace and tolerance date from the Meccan period when he was not in power. But the Islamic doctrine of abrogation is one that says that Allah can change or even cancel what he has told the Muslims. So later revelations can abrogate or cancel out previous revelations. And so that means very simply that the verses of the sword abrogate the verses that talk about peace. Well, let's talk about the fourth PC statement, because oftentimes when we talk about jihad, I have a lot of people will say, well, yeah, okay, the Quran has verses about the sword. But wait a minute, the Bible has some of those. What about that? Aren't the Quran and Bible both violent books? So let's look at those issues. And the first is, I think it would be helpful for you just to see a couple of verses out of the Quran to see what they say. And I'm going to pick them out of one chapter, Surah 9. As a matter of fact, I'd like to give you a homework assignment. I know you didn't want a homework assignment here. You got enough homework assignment. But I'm going to suggest to you that over the next month, if you can, I'm going to encourage you to read one chapter out of the Quran. I think it's helpful for you to read it. I wouldn't use it for your morning quiet time, but I would suggest to you that you read one chapter at least out of the Quran. And the chapter I'm going to suggest that you read is Surah 9, the ninth chapter. Now, you could go buy a Quran. I've got multiple copies. If you want one, I could give you one. Or you could look at one in a bookstore or a library. You can read it online. You don't have to spend any money if you don't want to. But I would encourage you to do so, so that you could read it for yourself. But I'm going to do some of your homework for you right now. And that is to show you a couple of the classic verses in Surah 9. And one of those is Surah 9:5. This one is quoted all the time. Fight and slay the pagans wherever you find them, and seize them, beleaguer them, and lie in wait for them in every stratagem. So you can see that that's a pretty clear interpretation there. By the way, these interpretations are coming from this particular version of the Quran written and translated by a Muslim. And you can look at different translations. We've got some by English-speaking individuals, Arabic-speaking individuals, some that were Muslim, some that are Christians. They're pretty much the same, but you can look at different translations along the way. But you see this in Surah 9:5. Let's look at another. Surah 9:29, fight those who believe not in Allah, nor the last day, nor hold that forbidden which hath been forbidden by Allah and His Prophet, nor acknowledge the religion of truth, even if they are of the people of the book, until they pay the jizya with willing submission and feel themselves subdued. Now, there's a lot of words there, but let's sort them out here. First of all, it talks about people of the book. Who are people of the book? Jews and Christians, okay? So actually, there was a teaching early on that there were as an attempt to, first of all, bring in the house of Islam, Dar al-Islam. But then also, there was this idea of Dar al-Harb, the house of war. So there were faithful Muslims and there were infidels. But Muhammad also taught that there might be some people in the middle, and those are people of the book. Because after all, they sort of are closer to Islam because they, you know, hold to prophets like Moses and Jesus, and maybe eventually they could be convinced that Muhammad would be a prophet. So they sort of had second-class status, but in order to live, they also had to, because they had second-class status, pay the jizya or a poll tax to survive. Well, I'm showing you some of these, and I'm encouraging you to read Surah 9 because it was one of the last chapters written, one of the last parts of the surah, so the doctrine of abrogation fits. And also, if you read through Surah 9, you run into jihad at least four times before you get into even to the first 35 verses. But read it for yourself and see indeed what is being communicated there. So we can see that it's talking about fight those who do not believe, fight and slay the pagans wherever you find them, and that's what we find in the Quran. Okay. What do we find in the Bible? Well, let's look at a passage in the Old Testament. Here in 1 Samuel 15, Saul is told by Samuel, ultimately by the Lord, "Thus says the Lord of hosts, I will punish Amalek for what he did to Israel, how he set himself against him on the way while he was coming up from Egypt. Now go and strike Amalek and utterly destroy all that he has, and do not spare him, but put to death both man and woman, child and infant, ox and sheep, camel and donkey." Now, first of all, who was Amalek? Well, if you go back and look at Exodus, you recognize that as the children of Israel were leaving Egypt and they were traveling around, Amalek was kind of the terrorist of that day, 20th century B.C. terrorist that came and attacked them and bitterly fought them. And eventually Moses and Joshua and others tried to fight. And during the battle, when Moses' hand was raised, you might remember this, then the Israelites began to prevail. But eventually he got tired of holding his hand up. And as he dropped his hand, then the Amalekites began to prevail. And so eventually people were trying to hold his hand up so that he would finish the battle. But when you go through Exodus, you don't really finish the job. This was a very evil group of individuals who had been attacking them, and so now God is calling for Saul to destroy them. Now, recognize that this was a very direct and specific command about Amalek and the Amalekites. If you're an Amalekite today, maybe you should be concerned, but it was only talking about the Amalekites. In the next verse, it goes on and says, "And spare the Kenites." There was a group near them called the Kenites, and it specifically says, make sure there's no collateral damage. Attack the Amalekites, but don't attack the Kenites. And so I think this begins to help us see at least a little bit of a difference between those. And that is, in the Old Testament, there was a direct and specific command to fight against a particular group of people. Who were those? The Amalekites. More than that, these were commands given during the Old Testament theocracy and only apply to those people at that time. Do you see the point? I would suggest that it's a little bit different than what we find in the Quran, because indeed the passages in the Quran apply to all unbelievers at all times. And this again helps us understand radical Islam, because if you read the fatwas of Osama bin Laden, he quotes some of those verses I just gave you. I don't know of any Christian today quoting from the Old Testament calling for the destruction of individuals, but I do know of individuals that indeed are in very significant positions of power using those verses to call for a jihad warfare against the West. But if you do a contrast for just a minute between the Quran and the New Testament, you see something I think even more interesting. Because in the New Testament, we see that believers in the New Testament are called upon to love their enemies, and they are to turn the other cheek. And so I think what you see here is the more literal I take an interpretation of the New Testament, the more peace-loving I might be. But the more literal I take an interpretation of the Quran, the more warlike I would be. So there's a very significant contrast that I think we see there. Let's take a fifth one, and that is the Quran and the Bible are basically the same. I've seen this in some religion classes. You know, all religions are basically the same. And I said, yeah, all of them are basically the same. They only disagree on heaven, hell, God, and salvation, and a variety of other small issues. But other than that, yeah, they're pretty much the same. And I think you hear this idea being expressed, and there's some reason for that. And that is, there are some similarities between the Bible and the Quran. For example, both Islam and Christianity are both religions of the book. Both of them claim divine revelation. And both of them claim that the book of Revelation has been accurately preserved through the centuries. So I will admit that there are some similarities, but it isn't the similarities that we should focus on, it's the differences. And the reason for this is I find this is also a very good way sometimes to witness to my Muslim friends. And that is to simply take something that you can learn in kind of the first day of philosophy, and that is what is called the law of non-contradiction. That is, if A is true, the opposite of A can't be true at the same time in the same way. Would you agree? If A is true, the opposite of A can't be true at the same time. If you have mutually contradictory statements being made, they both can't be true. They both could be false, but they both can't be true. And so that, I think, oftentimes creates an interesting discussion. Let me give you some examples of where the Bible and the Quran make mutually exclusive statements which are contradictory. You with me on that? Okay. Let's take the first one. The Quran teaches that Christians worship three gods: God the Father, God the Mother Mary, and God the Son Jesus. Okay? And you can find that in Surah 5. But the Bible actually teaches that there is one God in three persons. This morning when I was talking, I said that one of the things I think is going to be very important in terms of any of you that are in Christian leadership, as I think we're going to have to spend some time teaching about the Trinity and how to defend the Trinity. But you can see that that's a mutually exclusive claim about theology. Let's take another one. The Quran teaches that Abraham was going to sacrifice Ishmael. The Bible teaches that Abraham was going to sacrifice Isaac. Very different view of biblical history. Let's take a third one. The Quran teaches that Jesus was not crucified, that an imposter was crucified in his place, that he escaped Assyria, eventually died, and he's going to return someday and destroy all pigs and all crosses, marry, have children, die, and be buried next to Muhammad. That, I would suggest to you, is a very different view than the idea that Jesus was crucified on the cross and then died, rose again, and is seated in the right hand of the Father. So you can see that we have contradictory statements being made. Both of them could be false, but both of them cannot be true. And so it's, again, an opportunity to get a discussion going about what is indeed true. Let's look at this one. It's another one of those charts I like to put up here, but if you want to look at some of the differences between Christianity and Islam, Christianity, God is one God in three persons. Islam, God, is an absolute one. Christianity, Jesus is the second person of the Trinity, whereas Islam would say Jesus was a major prophet, but not God. Christianity would say that Jesus rose from the dead. Islam would say Jesus did not die on the cross nor rise. Christianity would say the Bible is the Word of God. Islam would teach that the Bible is corrupted. Christianity teaches that human beings are sinful by nature. Islam actually teaches that human beings are good by nature, but just forgetful and sometimes make mistakes. Christianity teaches salvation by grace. Islam teaches salvation by works, by following the five pillars of Islam. I would suggest to you that if you look at that chart again, you couldn't have two more different religions, correct? And so I don't think that it honors either Christianity or Islam to say that the two religions are basically the same. Let's look at a sixth statement, and I'll move away from some of the theological issues into maybe some of the ones we're fighting now and dealing with, and that is some people have asked the question, are we fighting a war on terror, or are we fighting radical Islam, or Islamo-fascists, or things of that nature? Because Paul Williams, in his book, The Dunces of Doomsday, says, you know, this slogan doesn't help us very much, because we're fighting a war without a name. We're not really engaged in a war on terror. Not only does he say that, but I noticed Charles Krauthammer writing in the Washington Post the other day said that we're no more fighting a war on terror in the 21st century than in World War II we were fighting a war against kamikazes in World War II. That is a tactic. Terror is a tactic, but we need to identify who indeed we're fighting. And so some people say we're fighting against Al-Qaeda, but Al-Qaeda is only one small part of a larger terror network. And many people are arguing that you really can't win a war when you can't even name who the enemy is. And if you think about this, there are some people that have even begun to suggest that maybe we're a part of what you could call World War III. I won't get into that debate tonight, but when you begin to look at where this battle is taking place, we have current conflicts, for example, in Afghanistan, in Chechnya, in Iran, in Iraq, in Indonesia, the Philippines, and Somalia. You have attacks that have taken place against the United Kingdom, against Spain, against France, against the United States, and many other countries, and you can see that it really has become a global war, indeed. And so it is more than just a military battle in the Middle East. The most recent attempts to try to destroy various airliners in the United Kingdom was actually interdicted not on a battlefield, but by actually tracing fund transfers to prevent what could have been another 9/11 kind of disaster, which could have unfolded over the Atlantic. But even in our own country, you've got to ask ourselves, are we thinking clearly about this issue? Because we have about 1,400 mosques in America, and 90% of them have been built with money in the last 20 years from Wahhabi funds in Saudi Arabia. Now, who are the Wahhabis? Well, it turns out that the Wahhabi Sunnis were very significant in 9/11. As a matter of fact, the 9/11 hijackers were all Wahhabi Sunnis, and they received support from at least seven different U.S. mosques. Osama bin Laden is a Wahhabi Sunni. So what are Wahhabi Sunnis? Well, there are Sunnis, there are Shiites, there are Sufis, but among the Sunnis, there's a subgroup called Wahhabi Sunnis. Just as Christianity had a Protestant Reformation, so Islam had a Muslim Reformation in the 18th century. And a man by the name of Wahhab called Muslims back to a literal, strict interpretation of jihad, and at that time was calling for them to overthrow colonial rulers like Great Britain. The modern view of Wahhabi is to use this idea of jihad warfare to fight against the United States and to also call for the destruction of Israel. And you can see that if you start tracing the money, these mosques are funded by individuals who tend to be some of the most virulent forms of Muslims in the world today. If you begin to look at the network of terrorists, the Zarat, all good Muslims are to give 5% of their income, 1/20th of their income, to what is known as the Zarat. It's like a collection. Some of that is used to advance Muslim causes, but oftentimes it also goes to various groups that are involved in terrorism. And that just gives you a little bit of a map of Islamic terror network in America and begins to illustrate what I think is a very significant challenge for us today. Imagine if you were Secretary of Homeland Security and each day you had a chance to look at a map like that. You can see that we are certainly, for the long term, facing lots of issues. Now, what about this one? And that is, there are lots of moderate Muslims. Well, in one sense, this is very true. Matter of fact, most of the Muslims I run into on college campuses, most of the Muslims I have as friends, I would consider to be moderate Muslims. Well, that gets back to this issue of interpretation. And a fair number of Muslims that I've run into over the years really don't know that much about the teaching in the Quran because they cannot read it in its original Arabic. That's because, number one, that the Quran is in a fairly difficult, even classical form of Arabic, and actually most Muslims are not Arab. I've run into students that have said, you know, I've memorized sections of the Quran and someday I want to find out what it says. Now, I've met Christians that have said, I've read the Bible and don't know what it means. So, I mean, it's not like that's unusual, but it just, I think, illustrates that. There are also a lot of Muslims, especially in the modern world, that have tended to contextualize the message of the Quran. They said, well, these were verses for that time, but interestingly enough, they do not apply today. So I'll be the first to admit that there are lots of moderate Muslims. And there's been a real debate in the United States. How many moderate Muslims compared to how many that might believe in jihad? And I've said, well, okay, give me a percentage. And I've heard a lot of people say, well, you know, I'm thinking that it's probably 99% of all Muslims in America are moderate Muslims. They are actually not interested in jihad. They're just here to enjoy the fruits of American culture and things like that. And I said, okay, I think 99% might be at least in the right ballpark. So you're saying that 99% are good, but 1% are of concern. Would you say that? And people say, sure. Okay, we have 7 million Muslims in this country. So you just told me we have 70,000 radical Muslims in the United States. At this point, usually somebody puts up their hands and says, wait, that can't be right. Maybe like, how about more like, say, 1/10 of 1%? Okay, 7 million Muslims, why 1/10 of 1%? You have still 7,000 radical Muslims. And again, understand what you face if indeed you're the Secretary of Homeland Security. In other countries, I'm sure the percentage is much higher. There's a lot of evidence right now coming from Scotland Yard that the percentage is much higher in London than it is here. And so again, while we would recognize that most Muslims are peace-loving, we still have to recognize the rest. But one thing I'd like to mention before I move on is even when you hear of an individual being identified as a moderate Muslim, check it out. One American Muslim spokesperson that I hear about most often is a man by the name of Siraj Wahaj. He's fairly well known because he was the first Muslim to give an invocation in the U.S. Congress. He's been invited to the White House a number of times and things like that. And after 9/11, he even said that he felt responsible to preach, actually to go on to a jihad against extremism, and said he really wanted to argue against and fight against this idea of a radical reaction and a violent reaction to the United States government. And in many cases, he said just exactly what the media and the American people wanted to hear. But let's, again, go and look at some of his other statements. And don't believe me, you all probably know how to do Google search, type in his name and see what's up there, because there's quite a bit. Because he also warned that the United States would fall unless it accepts the Islamic agenda. And more than that, he even lamented that if only Muslims were clever politically, they could take over the United States and replace its constitutional government with a caliphate. And that's a little bit different than most people would have expected. And probably the most significant one is he also sponsored talks with Sheikh Oman Abdel Rahman, who was the one who was later convicted for conspiring to blow up the World Trade Center in 1993. And Siraj Wahaj was actually listed in one document as an unindicted co-conspirator. If you watch the ABC movie tomorrow night and Monday night, you might even hear a little bit about him. So again, when you hear somebody called a moderate Muslim, that may be true, but if you do a little more research, sometimes you find out something else. A couple more, and then I'll open up for some questions. We're doing all we can to secure our borders. Heard that one about our war on terror. Well, I'm sensing a little bit of disagreement in the audience. Each day, we have about 4,000 illegal immigrants entering the United States through America's back door. Now, 4,000 is quite a bit, but to give you some perspective, that is equivalent to 60 jumbo jetliners coming from Mexico, coming from Canada, coming from other ways. And the ones that should concern us, at least in terms of terrorism, there's going to be an ongoing debate about immigration in Congress, and I understand that, but setting that aside, one that certainly should concern us is that a significant percentage of these immigrants coming in are what are called OTMs. What's that? Other than Mexican. That's the designation used by the Immigration and Naturalization Group. And those OTMs are coming from countries like Iraq and Iran and Afghanistan and places like that. And so, as a matter of fact, lately, I'm living in the state of Texas these days, and the story of finding one campsite where there was all sorts of Iranian literature, another one they were able to interdict in Afghanistan, national who was probably interested in coming here not to make themselves better, not to enjoy the benefits of American culture, but here for very different kinds of reasons. That's not the only areas in which we certainly have two borders there, but also the United States has 16,000 ships entering its ports every single day. Very few containers are ever inspected. I've heard all sorts of debates about what the percentage is, but I've always seen them in the 1-2%, never seen them even in the double figures. And there have been questions being raised over the last few years about the organizations or the countries or the companies providing security for us. The ninth one is we no longer face a nuclear threat. You've probably heard that before. No longer a Soviet Union, no longer have missiles aimed at us, no longer face a nuclear threat. Well, let's think about this for a minute. Paul Williamson probably does the best job in his book talking about this, and he points out that during the 1990s, the United States and the Soviet Union began to build down their weapons, and that was a very good thing, but unfortunately, it was happening at the same time when Russia was beginning to fall apart. So Russia was moving about 22,000 different nuclear weapons at the same time when the Soviet Union was beginning to unravel. So I have a question for you. Is it reasonable to believe that all of these were safely transported and secured? And while you're thinking about that, recognize that at that time, a gram of cesium-137 was selling for $1 million. And you can begin to see the concerns on the part of many as to whether or not we've lost track of some of those nuclear weapons. Another issue is about these so-called nuclear suitcase bombs. This has to do with the fact that the Chechenian mafia, that's how they spell mafia over there, actually became a dominant force in the trafficking of nuclear weapons. And one individual, a Chechen leader, provided protection of these weapons for mass destruction and actually contacted at one point the State Department, said that he possessed those and was willing to sell those to rogue states. He was really using that as a threat. And there at least was some evidence that he might have sold 20 suitcase bombs to Osama bin Laden and Al-Qaeda. Now the question is, number one, do they have suitcase bombs? Number two, were they able to maintain them? Because some of people have argued that even if Osama bin Laden had access to a suitcase bomb, it takes a fair amount of sophisticated engineering to maintain them. Otherwise, they simply are no longer effective. Recognize that Osama bin Laden has an engineering degree, and he might have access to others, but that's the big question that we have today about the whole issue of nuclear arms. I've had a chance to interview a number of people on this, one in particular, Senator John Kyle. He points out that terrorists would need no more than 5 pounds of plutonium or 35 pounds of highly enriched uranium to create a nuclear explosion. And also, we have the International Atomic Energy Agency between 1993 and 2004 that said that there were about 662 confirmed cases of smuggling of nuclear and radiological materials. So again, you can begin to see the concerns on the part of people, not only in this government and other governments, about whether or not that poses a threat. And my 10th and final PC statement that I hear sometimes is, well, we're involved in a war, but Christians shouldn't be involved in a war. After all, Christian teaching rejects the idea of warfare. In the interest of time, I won't get into that because it's almost another whole talk. And on our Probe website, we deal with some of that. But one book that came out in the last few years that I think at least helps us think about this from a Christian point of view in terms of the war on terror is a book called In the Name of God, Understanding the Mindset of Terrorism, in which Timothy Demme and Gary Stewart, who are evangelical pastors and chaplains in different branches of the military, I think have done a pretty good job of setting forth how Christians historically have thought about this issue of warfare. We see a great deal of that in Romans 13, 1-7. And, of course, we have had for some time in the history of the church what is known as the just war criteria. In other words, that we have certain principles that apply before a country would go to war. A just cause, just intention, a last resort, formal declaration, limited objectives. And then other principles that would apply once you are in the midst of war. The idea of proportionate means and non-combatant immunity. And so I'll say that there are all sorts of discussions that can take place there, but if nothing else, Christians have spent some time really thinking about how to apply a biblical perspective on war. Finally, let me at least encourage you to visit our website, especially you students. This is something you probably want to write down or pay attention to. We have on our probe website about 2,000 different articles and commentaries. We have questions that people will post, and we'll have an email question, an email answer. We have podcasts. We have streaming video. Hope that you'll take the time to visit there. If nothing else, if you're doing a term paper, if you're giving a speech, if you're involved in a debate, I've found that a lot of college students find that to be a very, very useful site, so I hope that you will take the time to visit it. If you're involved in teaching a Sunday school class or would just like some of these PowerPoint presentations, we have about 35 different PowerPoint presentations on all sorts of issues, the Da Vinci Code, intelligent design, men are from Mars, women from Venus, homosexuality, you name the issue. We've got quite a number of those up there. A quarter of a million visitors from last month from about 145 countries around the world. We have them in different languages. I know some of you have an outreach in the Hispanic community. We have about 135 articles in Spanish. We have them in Chinese, a number of other, Hungarian, to mention just a few. And so I hope that you'll take the time to visit the website and use that resource. Everything there is free, the price that you like. All of it's free. You're free to print it out. You're free to download it, to make copies, and use in your ministry any way you would like. So again, go to probe.org, and you'll find out a lot more about some of the issues there. Let's come up and close, everybody, and thank you for letting me be a part of this.